It's time for phenology. Phenology is the rhythmic, biological nature of events as they relate to climate. And boy, I'll tell you what, things are changing out there. It's getting pretty darn nice out. I don't know about you, but having been born and raised in Minnesota and spent just about all of my life north of, say, 47 degrees north latitude, I can't help but have this feeling that something, the other shoe is about to drop. I just feel like, you know, as nice as it is, we could wake up one of these days with 10 more inches of snow on the ground and temperatures down below zero. And I guess I'm hoping that won't happen. I'm reminded of 1987 when we had a really early spring, a beautiful warm spring. The robins were back around the 7th of March that month. Everybody was a little bit early, except for the great blue herons. And there's something about the blue herons that, I don't know, they don't seem to respond to temperature so much as day length, because in all the years I've been keeping track, the blue herons are pretty steady coming back right around the end of the month, usually within 3 or 4 days of the 1st of April. So it sometimes is the 25th of March, and sometimes it's the 5th of April, and sometimes it's somewhere in between, but it's never very many days between those two markers. So something other than weather seems to trigger them to return to northern Minnesota. Lots of reports of trumpeter swans in the area, and there have been a number of them on the Mississippi River all winter. There's a big population that hangs out down on the Mississippi down by Monticello, and they are moving north and looking for open water. So lots of people are spotting them flying about, and it's just a matter of kind of keeping your eyes open. These big white birds, you know, they're pretty hard to miss when they go by. They're so much bigger than a goose that they kind of startle you when you actually see them sitting next to a goose. Oftentimes, if you're lucky enough to have that happen, you'll notice that the goose looks, in relation to the trumpeter swan, the goose looks the same size as a mallard does in relationship to a goose. And I suppose a goose can weigh up to about, oh, maybe 8-10 pounds. A mallard, probably a big, fat, healthy mallard might weigh 2 pounds. A big, fat, healthy trumpeter swan could weigh as much as 35 pounds. So they're big birds, and you won't miss them when they fly by. Now, this time of year, most of those big swans, in fact, I would venture to say that all of those big swans that you see are going to be trumpeters, not tundra swans or whistling swans. The tundra swans come through in flocks as they migrate north. The tundra swans actually nest clear up in the Arctic, and some of them actually fly over into Russia and nest there, and then fly all the way back down to the Chesapeake Bay area to spend the winter. When they come through, it'll be just about the time the ice is going out of the lakes. They seem to follow the melting ice as it progresses north, and they will come through usually in large flocks this time, or that time of year. Not now, but probably further on into April. We had reports this week of chipmunks seen by Ed Dallas down in Deerwood and Ruth up here in the Grand Rapids area. First sightings of chipmunks. Average date for that is the 23rd of March. And just looking at my lists, looks like March 11th, March 7th in 1994. So they're early this year, and they will probably, you know, retreat back underground if they get a chance. If they feel a little bit of cold coming on, they'll probably dip back underground for a few days and wait for it to pass. So watch for the chipmunks. They'll probably, first place you'll see them most likely if you're feeding birds is right there underneath your bird feeder. So check for them, and if you get a chance, call in your report. Lots of barred owls in the area making calls, and had a report from Dallas Hudson over in Akeley. He's hearing the Hearing the saw-whet owls. Now, the saw-whet owl is one that really is, if you hear it, and usually you'll hear it either in the early evening or in the early morning, but they have a call that reminds me of one of those truck alarms when the truck is backing up, you know, it kind of... That sort of a call. It goes on and on and on. They can carry it on for quite a while, and they will continue to make that call. Now, the saw-whet owl, because of that sound, the whet in wet there is like whetting a knife or whetting a saw. Actually, W-H-E-T is how that's spelled, and it has to do with the sound of the owl. It sounds like, you know, the sawyer. Sawing, filing the saw. So listen for that. That's the saw-whet owl, the barred owl, of course. And beyond the barred owl, the great horned owl are, there's still a few choruses of the great horned owls, but they have settled onto their nests. And actually, by now, they're probably beginning to feed their babies. And so there will be some big furry white objects sitting in some appropriated nest out there. The great horned owls are well on their way, and you might still hear a few of them calling. I did have an opportunity this past week to watch as a group of crows mobbed a raven, and it was so typical. I mean, first there were two or three, and they passed the word, and then there were five, and then there were 10, and then there were 20, and more kept coming in, and they just kept harassing this raven until finally I wasn't able to pay close attention, and I couldn't get too close, but they finally just shut up, and I don't know if they got tired of harassing the raven and left, or if the raven left and the crows just moved on. But I'm reminded of an opportunity that I had once to watch this in the fall. I was out duck hunting with Baggy Bagshot, and we saw a great horned owl across the lake from us in an oak tree, and a few crows noticed it. And they sounded the alarm, and crows further out in a ring sounded the alarm, and that alarm carried further out in a ring, and they sounded the alarm, and that carried out further in the ring. And before it was all said and done, there had to be over 100 crows that came to harass that poor great horned owl. And the interesting thing was that these crows, most of them were probably out of earshot of that first alarm set up by the first crows, but the crows just kept passing the word further out and further out, sort of like ripples in a pond. And ultimately, there were a lot of crows there to keep that owl sort of awake and on edge for quite some time. So keep an eye out for that kind of behavior. If you hear the crows really getting wild, why, you might want to go and see what it is that's got them so worked up. Skunks are definitely out. I smelled my first skunk this past Friday, and Greg called this morning and said there was a skunk walking down Highway 10, so be careful if you're in that neighborhood. And there have been a number of calls about skunks, smelling skunks all over the area, and you may get a chance to do that in the next little while. One of the things I've noticed over the last week are the pussy willows are really popping out all over the area right now, so watch. Right now is a good time. And while you're watching for pussy willows, notice the color that's coming on the willows right now. They have, they range from greenish yellow to orange to coral to bright red. And they are everywhere. And they, especially with this wet weather, they jump right out at you. If you're driving around northern Minnesota and you can't spot the willows, you're not looking. They're really, really all over the place and very, very bright out there. Finally, yesterday I saw my first raccoon of the season. And for those of you who are fans of Gary Larson, used to do a cartoon called The Far Side. There's a one that remains in my mind very clearly, and it's an elderly professorial raccoon standing in front of a classroom full of little raccoons all sitting at desks. And on the blackboard, he's got a list. He said the title is Job Opportunities for raccoons. And the first five things on the list are roadkill. And this raccoon filled the bill. He was roadkill. So the crows will eat happy tonight, and we'll watch out for more raccoons as time goes by. That's the Phenology Show for today. Thanks for tuning in. As always, if you have comments, questions, or observations you want to share, please send them along. It's time for Talk Back. Talk Back is your opportunity to communicate with us. Maybe you've got an observation you'd like to share, or a comment you'd like to make, or a question you'd like to pose. It doesn't matter. We just love to hear from you. And you can get in touch with us. Our number is 999-9876. That's our Talk Back line. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can send it to comments@kaxe.org, or you can send them directly to me. My address is J Latimer, that's J-L-A-T-I-M-E-R, at kaxe.org. And you can always write to us. Our address is 260 Northeast 2nd Street, Grand Rapids, Minnesota, 55744. We did hear from a bunch of you this week, including Ed Dallas, who called to say that a week ago today, the first chipmunks were out at his house. And since then, they have been out in force. I've not seen a chipmunk yet myself, but this is certainly the time of year when you would want to be watching out for them. Ed also remarked that the red-bellied woodpeckers are getting quite noticeably louder and doing a lot of calling and hammering. And I have other notes from other folks who say that the red-bellied woodpeckers are, in fact, yes, getting out and starting to sing a little bit. And Ed was checking up on the internet, and he said that the hummingbirds, the ruby-throated hummingbirds that we commonly associate with arriving in northern Minnesota in the mid part of May, usually somewhere between the 5th and the 10th, have crossed the Gulf of Mexico. Those little birds flew that 600 miles of open water to reach the Gulf Coast shores as of about the 1st of March. So they're in the country. Now it's just a matter of waiting for the flowers to bloom so they can work their way north. We'll see them in another 2 months or so. We heard from Courtney, who said that Bohemian waxwings, a big flock of Bohemian waxwings, was seen in Grand Rapids this past week. And Gail Otteson sent us a note saying that the goldfinches at her house are starting to show a bit more yellow in the feathering department. The male goldfinches typically this time of year start molting, and all winter long they've been sort of drab, sort of a yellowish, greenish brown. But this time of year they begin to really exhibit that color that is so characteristic of them in the summertime. A lot of people call these canaries, and they are, in fact, not canaries, but they certainly have that appearance because of their bright yellow back and breast, and the black patch on the top of the head, the black tail, and the black wings with the bright white wing bars. So watch the goldfinches as they come to your feeders. And if they're not coming to your feeder and you'd like to get them there, you might try putting out thistle seed. They like thistle seed. So good luck with that, and let us know, of course, what's coming to you. We heard by phone this week from quite a group of people who actually three different reports of returning waterfowl.
Just calling on the Phenology to report that Jim and Kobe Buna of Lower Lawrence Lake spotted four or five swans flying over the lake today, and today is Wednesday. Thank you.
Hi, this is Cindy from Balsam. I'm about a mile south of Big Fork, and I just saw two trumpeter swans go past. I think that's what they were. They were big and white and a pair flying east to south of Big Fork. Pretty exciting. See ya. Bye.
Hi, this is Brooke and John Knisley of Bemidji. We saw two golden eyes on the open water on Lake Bemidji where the Mississippi flows into the lake.
All right. Couple of reports of swans in the area and golden eyes in the Bemidji area. Just about anywhere you're going to see open water, the rivers in the area and little streams leading in and out of area lakes, especially like Lawrence Lake, where there's a stream coming in. Well, the Prairie River comes in at the north end and goes out on the south end, and any of the other bodies of water around that have open water. I know Dallas Hudson from over at Shingabee Lake in Akeley always has reports of trumpeter swans. The trumpeter swans don't go very far south. There is quite a population on the Mississippi River around Monticello, Minnesota, and just about anywhere that there's open water, the trumpeter swans will stay the winter if they can find food. And around here, that's not impossible. So there are a lot of swans in the area, and of course, as the days get longer and more open water appears, they're going to be out looking for places to find more food and maybe head back to the lakes that they're spending the summers on. Trumpeter swans like small lakes with shallow areas where they can feed and not a lot of people. They don't like to be on lakes with lots of houses around the edges. So in the meantime, just keep your eyes open, and who knows, you might be the next one to see a trumpeter swan either flying or sitting on some open water near you. Speaking of Dallas, I got a note from him that said there was a bobcat that he saw out while he was taking a walk, and he's heard cardinals singing in the Akeley area, and on Sunday he heard his first goose calling, and the John Weber over in Nevis and his wife saw a pair of horned larks, and as I mentioned earlier, he mentions in this note that the trumpeter swans were out playing in front of the house at his place on Shingabee Lake this past week. And he also said that 11.6 inches of snow in the Akeley area, water content 1.92. He said, I haven't seen a grouse. I did see some snow scorpions and lots of deer tracks. So there's things out there to look at, even if you can't get out and see what you might be heading out for, grouse, in fact. And then he says, I heard a saw-wet owl bonking, as he calls it, and trumpeter swans really coming in, flocks of six and then three and then several pairs. They're feeding more like spring. And a friend of his reported three juncos near LaPorte. So lots of things going on. Not the kinds of things that you might expect in the way of real signs of spring. The robin migration hasn't really gotten this far north yet, but it's coming. And you might find in your neighborhood some robins sneaking in the next, well, in the next little while. 1987, earliest robins, the migration began on the 7th of March. Now, there are robins that spend the winter up here, and you might see a single or a couple of robins, but what really marks the migration is that you'll see a robin one day, and the next day you'll see another robin, and the day after that another robin, and then maybe a flock of robins. So what you want to kind of think about the frequency of sighting. You know, just about every little town in northern Minnesota has a robin or two that have spent the winter, but they will be a lot more out there. And so when you start seeing them day after day, then remember back to the first day you saw them and say, okay, we've had the migration has begun. We also heard this week from Ruth, who called from the Grand Rapids area.
I just wanted to say that on March 2nd, my Blue Jays came back. They've been gone since November, and on March 2nd, they came back and are eating at the feeder again. On March 5th, I smelled my first skunk. And then on the 6th, going down to Walker, I noticed that their Balm of Gilead buds are much more advanced than ours are. You know, ours aren't that big yet. And the other thing is, this morning, March 8th, my chipmunk came out. He came out, and he also was running around on my underneath the house on the heating ducts, drove my cat crazy. And, John, I talked to you about my pileated woodpecker, how the male had disappeared, and I only have the female here. I have a brand-new male, and he's been eating at the feeder now. Have a good day.
Thank you, Ruth. Nice to hear that. Nice to have somebody reinforce Ed's sighting of a chipmunk. I think probably just about all of you listening this morning ought to be watching for chipmunks. They should be coming out any day now in your neighborhood. And yeah, you know, where there are females, the males will come. Just works that way. I don't know why. Got a note from Lyle who said, while driving into Squaw Lake today on County Road 32, there was a magpie sitting on top of a cow. It appeared to be eating something. I don't think that I've ever seen that before. And Courtney replied, that reminds me of something I saw across from my apartment in Missouri a few years ago. I saw this little bird diving down repeatedly onto a groundhog. When I got my binocs out, I saw it was a tufted titmouse gathering nesting material. The groundhog seemed mildly annoyed, but mostly ignored it. I don't know. I doubt that the magpie was gathering any nesting material from the back of the cow. But Lyle went on to say, checking on the internet, it's a rather common behavior for magpies to sit on the backs of domestic animals while they eat ticks and other insects and other carrion from wounds on the animal. Such behavior may do the animals more harm than good, according to the article. And I thought that this only occurred in Africa with hippos and elephants. So keep your eyes out. You never know when you might see a magpie sitting on the back of a cow. That's Talk Back for today. If you have messages that you'd like to share, send them along.
You're listening to Phenology Plus on KAXE, Community Radio for Northern Minnesota, 91.7 on the Iron Range, Big Fork, and Aiken, 89.9 in the Brainerd area, and 105.3 in Bemidji. Audio streaming on the internet at KAXE.org. I'm Scott Hall with John Latimer. Coming up, John talks with Tom Hewitt. Tom's a botanist with the Chippewa National Forest. And Kathy Dodge and I speak with Elaine Evans about bees and other pollinators. Phenology Plus is made possible by our listener members and by Dale's Auto Body in Grand Rapids. At Dale's Auto Body, customer satisfaction is based on 25 years of experience. Staff at Dale's is ready and willing to answer questions concerning the repair and estimating process. At Dale's Auto Body, repairs are vital to a vehicle's performance, safety, and resale value. We also have support from Itasca Surgical Clinic in Grand Rapids. At the Itasca Surgical Clinic, patients are provided with personal screening, diagnosis, and treatment of a full range of medical conditions, all in a caring environment. It's time for a talk on the wild side, and tonight John Latimer talks with botanist Tom Hewitt from the Chippewa National Forest about spotted knapweed, garlic mustard, and other invading plants and animals that can wreak havoc on our native plants.
Well, I just wanted to start off by you folks out there listening, I'm sure most of you know what a great resource you have with this radio station and Mr. Latimer here. And I recently moved to the area, and I tuned into the station a few times, and I had a question. I was trying to figure out what time of year that weed we have growing on the Chippewa and a lot of northern Minnesota here called spotted knapweed, and it's kind of a problem weed for us. And I'm working on managing it. And something we were looking at was trying to mow it. And if you mow it at the right time of the year, you're going to hurt it. And if you mow it at the wrong time of the year, you're going to help it along. So I had heard this phenology show, and I thought, well, this is a phenology question. So I sent Mr. Latimer an email, and I asked him, do you know what time of year this thing flowers? And can you give me any clue here? And a day later, I get an email with a small Excel spreadsheet attached to it with the earliest peak and final flowering times of spotted knapweed for the last 10 years. And I was just astounded by this wealth of knowledge that we have here. So I just wanted to thank him for that.
Well, you're more than welcome. I hope that it can help. You mentioned that this is sort of an invasive species. Are we having a problem here?
Well, I really don't know. I can tell you what, spotted knapweed is a tremendous problem in the West, in places in Montana, Idaho, and it's a big problem in rangelands in the northern Rockies, and it's devastated probably millions of acres of rangeland, and we're seeing it move into the northern tier here, and or the north the Great Lakes area, we're not really sure what it's going to do here.
You know, I was surprised because in looking at my records, I know that back in the 80s, I had no records of it. I'd never seen it before. In fact, I could probably go back and pinpoint the actual first time I saw it blooming here. One of those flowers where I looked at it and I thought, what the heck is this? Got out of the car, you know, got my Newcomb's Guide out and started leafing my way through it. And every year, I see more and more of it. What exactly does it do? I mean, is it like crowding out other plants? Is that the problem? Or
well, around here, it mostly seems we were mostly only seeing it on disturbed sites, roadsides, gravel pits, and the like. Power line corridors, things like that. Not your prime habitat, but it's moving fast enough that it's a real concern, and it may be a concern in places that experience some sort of natural disturbance. But really, for me, the jury's still kind of out on this one, is whether it's really public enemy number one. But there certainly is a lot of it. If you drive on Route 2 towards Bemidji, there's a hillside that's covered with it, and somebody takes a lawnmower or something and carves "Go Vikings" in there every so. it grows pretty thick, uh-huh. And we're seeing, it's kind of exploding. But the big question remains whether it's going to be whether it's just going to stay in those kind of disturbed sites, or it's going to move into our more pristine environments.
Yeah. So what else is, besides the spotted knapweed, what other concerns are there at the CHIP?
Well, I guess public enemy number one is a plant called garlic mustard. Now, the name sounds like something you might want to eat, like a nice condiment. it gets that name because it's in the mustard family, and it smells like garlic. Maybe like garlic that's been sitting around a little bit too long. It's a little rancidy smelling, and it is edible. And everyone's welcome to go out and eat as much as you want. But this is really a serious concern. We're focusing on it for a number of reasons. One is that over most of the deciduous forests of the East, it's become a real pest. And this is not just a weed that stays in disturbed sites. This is one that moves into pretty pristine, rich hardwood forests and mesic hardwood forests, and it completely takes over. It will form a 90% cover, and it crowds out other plants. Its roots exude chemicals into the soil that can inhibit the germination of other plants. And it's thought to interfere with fungi in the soil, and this is a real bad actor. And if you go further south of here into the Midwestern and Eastern states, it's a huge problem for land managers down there, and it's part of kind of one of several threats to our hardwood forests here. And the upside of it is we've got somewhere between 20 and 60 acres, depending on how you count them, just restricted to the Stony Point area near Walker on Leech Lake. And the next nearest infestations are maybe 100 miles away. So it's very limited in its extent here. And we have a chance to sort of knock it down or at least contain it while we can.
If I were wandering around the CHIP, what would I see? What does this stuff look like so that if somebody comes across it, they can uproot it or
Well, it's a biennial. It comes, it forms little rosettes of kidney-shaped leaves in the spring. It greens up a lot earlier than most plants do in the springtime, and stays green later in the fall than most. The second year, it bolts and produces a panicle of white flowers. You know, if you want to learn to identify it, you can easily, if you Google garlic mustard, you'll find links to lots of sites. There's lots of folks out there putting out information on how to identify it. Oh, and the easy way is you just, if you think you got it, pluck a leaf off, crush it, and smell it. And if you smell the garlic, it's pretty easy to tell.
I like those kinds of plants.
Yeah, it's an easy one.
This kind of reminds me of, oh, yeah, that's the stuff. So
yeah. And, you know, I'd really like to know, I'm new to this area, and really like to know if we have more of these out here, especially if they're small populations, we can jump on early. So, you know, I'd encourage anyone who spots this out there, I'd like to have as many eyes on the ground looking for this one as possible.
So I'm walking through the forest, minding my own business, and I come across these white flowers, and I pick a leaf, and I crush it, and I smell it, and I go, oh, my, rotten garlic. What do I do next? Who do I contact? How do I make the contact?
Call me, Tom the Botanist, Chippewa National Forest in Cass Lake.
All right. And
or you can call your local ranger district or DNR office.
Just get it to DNR or the feds and let them know.
Yeah.
And if, you know, a lot of people these days are out in the woods with GPS machines, so
yeah.
I suppose if you could pinpoint it like that, just put a waypoint in and say, I found it at this waypoint, really be helpful. Otherwise, I suppose, you know, I was a quarter mile north of County Road, whatever, and it was in a little swale out there. And so some kind of a location and the fact that you found some garlic mustard. What else should we be watching out for?
Well, another one is common buckthorn. It's a shrub. Again, you can look it up on the internet to identify it. And it's another one that stays green pretty late in the fall after all the other shrubs have dropped their leaves. It's one that I'm not super familiar with. We didn't have it up in Alaska where I've been working recently. But it does grow in the forests in our area. It's not really prevalent in northern Minnesota, but it seems to be gaining a toehold here.
It is coming, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, right here along the Riverwalk, there's quite a spread of it. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that one is another focus we want to look at. Some other things coming up, you know, most of you all have heard about the emerald ash borer that's on its way. Don't move firewood,
right.
Unless you want to kiss your ash goodbye. another one I'd like to talk about real quick is earthworms. Now, I always grew up, you know, if you're like me, earthworms are a good thing. And we've always been taught earthworms are a good thing, but then it turns out that in the more recently glaciated parts of North America, there were no earthworms after the glaciers receded. And then the plant communities that formed here were not adapted to have earthworms as part of that system. And it turns out in these hardwood forests, sugar maple, basswood, those types of forests, they are not adapted to earthworms. And earthworms get in there and they eat up every little scrap of leaf litter there is until you have just bare mineral soil. Obviously, that's not good for all the other little plants and probably a lot of the critters that live on that forest floor. And these are spreading fast. And in places where they're spread, it's pretty obvious. You can see hardly anything growing on the forest floor there. So the one thing I can say about that is if you're out fishing, you got those earthworms, drop them in the garbage. Don't drop them in the ground, especially if there's a hardwood forest nearby.
Tom Hewitt is a botanist with the Chippewa National Forest. You can see pictures of the spotted knapweed and garlic mustard on the Phenology page. That's at our website, kaxe.org. The Itasca County Master Gardeners are hosting a Relying on the Land day full of workshops to help you get ready for the growing season. There's going to be 12 workshops in all, including one on extending the growing season and heirloom seeds and seed saving. Elaine Evans will give the keynote address on protecting bees and other pollinators. The registration deadline is this Friday, March 12th. You can register online at getlearning.org or call KAXE. The actual date of the workshops is March 27th, so give us a call for more information. And we're delighted to have Elaine Evans on the line with us. She has written a book called Befriending Bumblebees, and we'll be giving that keynote address on conservation of native crop pollinators. Thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
You know, in recent years, we've heard that bees are in trouble in North America. Is that true? Is it still true?
It is still true. For when you're talking about bees, there's a lot of different things happening. Most people, when you say bees, the first thing that comes into mind is the honeybee, which is a very important crop pollinator and the one that people rely on the most. But there are 4,000 species of native bees in North America. So when you say bee, you're meaning a lot of different things. Mm.
Are all of them pollinators?
All of them are pollinators. Not all of them are crop pollinators, so they all collect pollen and nectar to feed themselves and their young. And, you know, in the process, they're moving pollen around and pollinating plants. Some of them are important pollinators for a lot of native plants. And a wide variety of all the different kind of flowers that are out there. In terms of plants that we're reliant on, you know, those are the bigger crops. So honeybees are the primary pollinator of those commercially produced crops.
Uh-huh.
But there are native pollinators also that play an important role with that.
So how would you describe the health of bee populations here in Minnesota or around the United States?
For honeybees, that's a little easier to document since they are domesticated and people are taking care of them, and there's a lot of research that happens with honeybees. We do know that there's been a big decline in the number of colonies that beekeepers are maintaining, and there's been a lot of talk in the last few years about this, but this has been a decline that's been happening over the last 50, 60 years due to a variety of things. Honey prices have been dropping over that time, making it more difficult for honeybeekeepers to stay in business. And then on top of that, over the last 30 years, there's been increasing problems with diseases. And the most recent one is colony collapse disorder, which has been very severe.
Are the diseases just naturally occurring, or do we know of any causes of the diseases?
For the longer-term picture of things, one of the big problems that honeybees have had is a mite that's called the varroa mite, and that's been around for quite a while. And this mite, you know, feeds on the blood of the honeybees and on their larvae, mostly the little babies that are in the colony there. And the mites, when they're feeding on the bees, transfer viruses.
Oh.
So it's this compounding thing where the mites have a certain impact, but then the mites also spread diseases. And so when the varroa mites came into the U.S., they were on a different species of honeybee that was in Asia that had resistance to these mites. But when the mites migrated to the European honeybees, which are the honeybees that we have here, it really decimated the population. So for the last 20 years, we haven't really had wild honeybee populations because these varroa mites wiped those out. So all the honeybees that we have here are mostly the ones that people are maintaining, the colonies that people are maintaining.
Now, your keynote address is going to be about protecting pollinators, conservation of native crop pollinators. What are some other pollinators other than bees?
There are several that are pretty important. The bumblebees are very important. They're actually commercially raised and used in greenhouses mostly, and they're also used outside for crop pollination. There's another group of bees that are called leafcutter bees. The blue orchard bee is one of the more popular ones. Those are used a lot for apple pollination. And so they're very different than honeybees in terms of the way that they're managed, but they can be used. And the problems that we've had with honeybees have shown that it's important to have another pollinator kind of in the basket to go to if you are having problems with one pollinator.
So all pollinators don't necessarily make honey, though. Is that true?
That's correct. Mm. Honeybees, there are some other bees that make honey, but they're mostly, there's a tropical bee that people do collect honey from. But in terms of the bees that we have here, they do collect the nectar from flowers, but they just use it themselves. Oh. They don't make it into honey. So in terms of honey, we really need honeybees,
Elaine,
for honey.
This is Kathy here with Scott. My knowledge of bees increased tenfold in the past 2 minutes. Where did the term bumble come from? I always thought bumble and honey were just the same bee, and I thought all bees were honeybees. But bumble is an interesting name.
It is. They're also called the humble bee, and I think it's the bumblebees are the big, really fuzzy ones. And they can be kind of loud. So I think the bumble comes from just the sound that they make when they're flying around. They make kind of a lower buzzing sound.
So they're the ones that, you know, when you're out and you see a bee and you see this really huge bee and you get nervous, that's the bumblebee?
Yeah. When you see the huge, you know, they're usually the yellow and black.
Yeah.
The honeybees, they're kind of skinnier and they're furry and hairy, but not to the same extent. Mm-hmm.
So now we have all these species. Do they all sting?
They do all sting. One difference is that there's bees that are social and bees that are solitary. So bees that are social, they live in a nest together, like the honeybees have a big hive with, you know, thousands of bees that are in there. Bumblebees are actually also social, but they have smaller hives. But the social bees, the reason why they sting is they're protecting their colony. And so they tend to be more likely to sting you if you're near the nest. When the bees are out foraging on the flowers, it's not, you know, usually they're just busy collecting pollen and nectar. And bumblebees, you know, you can even, I like to, you know, freak people out by going up and petting the bumblebees while they're on the flower, because they're really distracted. They don't want to sting you.
Oh. We're speaking with Elaine Evans. She's written a book called Befriending Bumblebees, and she's going to give the keynote address later this month on March 27th at a special event sponsored by the Itasca County Master Gardeners. The event's called Relying on the Land, a series of 12 workshops on gardening and the environment. And Elaine will be speaking about the conservation of native crop pollinators, protecting those pollinators. Elaine, how did you get interested in this?
I started working with pollinators back in 1995, and I had studied biology in college, and I developed just an interest in insects in general. I was interested in conservation. And it seemed to me that there was this huge gap in terms of people's knowledge and what people were talking about for conservation with insects, since insects do so many important things for us. I mean, the pollination is clearly important. One out of every three bites of food that we're eating is coming from pollinators. There's other things, you know, that they do, you know, all over the environment that are key processes for keeping everything running. But people weren't talking about the need to protect them. And so I developed an interest in insects in the hope of learning what I can do to help promote their conservation. And then I started working with pollinators when I was at the University of Minnesota. And it was actually before I started my graduate work there. I volunteered on a project that was looking at insect pollination in prairies. And I was hooked as soon as I was out there with the flowers and the bees. And it's so beautiful just being out there and with the flowers and the sunshine in the summer, because the bees aren't out when it's raining, so so it's a really good excuse to just get out and spend time out in the beauty of nature in the summer, and to see the intimate interactions with the flowers and the bees, and how that just impacts everything else on down the line.
So, speaking of flowers, if I wanted to have, is there such a thing as a bee garden?
There is. I've got one out on my boulevard here. Butterfly gardens is something people have talked about a lot, and where people are planting flowers that attract butterflies. A lot of those flowers will also end up attracting bees, too. Mostly you want to have flowers that are producing nectar and pollen. They're actually some of the horticultural hybrids. They look beautiful, but they don't produce nectar. So some of those aren't going to be any good to bees, even though they look pretty. Native flowers are a good way to go, because we know that they're producing nectar and pollen. The most popular bee flowers for bees are ones that are in the blue to purple range. Their range of color vision is different than ours, and different than butterflies also. All bees, they don't see into the red vision, but they see into ultraviolet. So red flowers, white flowers are not going to be good bee flowers, but everything else from that color range on, orange and blue and purple, those are all going to be good bee flowers.
Are butterflies pollinators?
Butterflies are pollinators also.
Oh, okay.
They're not used commercially, but they're very important pollinators of native plants.
Elaine Evans is the author of Befriending Bumblebees, and Evans will give the keynote address on protecting bees and other pollinators at the Itasca County Master Gardeners Relying on the Land Day of Workshops to help people get ready for the gardening season. There's going to be 12 workshops in all, including ones on extending the growing season and heirloom seeds and seed saving. The registration deadline is this Friday, March 12th, and the actual day of the workshops is Saturday, March 27th. Call KAXE for more information, 218-326-1234. Phenology Plus is made possible by our listener members and by Atchison Tire Company in Grand Rapids. Locally owned for more than 90 years, Atchison Tire has offered new tires and repair services for generations of their customers online at atchisontire.com. We also have support from the Bonner Eye Clinic in Grand Rapids. For over 40 years, the Bonner Eye Clinic has served the eye care needs of Grand Rapids, Itasca County, and the Iron Range, providing full-service ophthalmology, cataract, and LASIK refractive surgery, plus eye exams for glasses and contacts. Time now to visit with Eli Sagor. Eli's a forester with University of Minnesota Extension Service, and we visit with Eli each month about what's new at myminnesotawoods.org, which is a website for people who want to know anything about trees and forests of Minnesota. If it's not there, you can start a discussion or ask a question about it, and away you'll go to learn more about our forests and trees. Welcome back, Eli.
Thanks, Scott. It's good to be back.
Say, before we get too far into what's on the website today, this website, I know you strive to make it a service that people can use on a regular basis, and you've got a new thing here called Find a Forester, and why is that important for people to know?
Well, this is important for a bunch of reasons, and it's something we've been working on for a long time. We finally found what we think is the right way to do it. Local professional foresters really are just a great asset for woodland owners, and there are folks that woodland owners need to be talking to. Foresters do a lot of things. The purpose of this map, this new resource that we've got this month, is to connect landowners with local professionals who can write a woodland stewardship plan. These are people who are eligible and approved by the DNR to write these stewardship plans. Why are stewardship plans important? Well, a lot of your listeners, I know, have heard us talk before, and I know others on your station talk about these new incentive payment and property tax programs, the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, the new 2C managed forest lands tax classification, and a variety of other things that really can save woodland owners quite a bit of money or provide incentives for good forest management. But in order to do that, you need to, in order to enroll in those, you need to have a current woodland stewardship plan. Current means no more than 10 years old. And because those programs have been so attractive, a lot of landowners have been signing up and requesting new stewardship plans. And this resource, this new map, gives landowners one more way to find a local professional, start contacting professionals, figure out how to get a plan as quickly as possible. The plan isn't just that, though. I mean, one thing it does is, as I said, to make you eligible for those programs. But when you get that plan, the process of obtaining it will put you in touch with a professional who will come out and visit your property, walk the property with you, find out what's important to you, what you want to get out of that property, how you want to manage it, and so on, and give you not only an inventory of exactly what's on your land, but also some good advice about how to go about that. So stewardship plans are really a great resource, and this new map should make it easier for landowners to find a local professional to help with that.
Yeah, and it also kind of cuts through the middleman. I know we've received some calls here at the station after visiting with you, and people saying, how can I find a forester? And, you know, we have DNR offices in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, regional offices that we generally refer people to, but this way you can go directly to myminnesotawoods.org and kind of find out quicker, I think, where to go and what's near you.
Those DNR foresters and those offices are all listed, too. Yeah, and just one other quick thing on this. Landowners do have a couple of options. One option, and a great place to start, is to call the nearest DNR office. And again, those are all listed on this map. But the other, and sometimes those offices, especially now, some of the DNR, not all of them, but some of the DNR area offices do have a backlog. So it might take a few months to get that stewardship plan. Some landowners are electing, instead of waiting, they're electing to pay the full cost of that plan, rather than get the discount that they're able to get through the DNR. And those are called cash plans, paying the full price of a cash plan prepared by an approved private consulting forester or industry forester is another option. And again, this map includes both private and public sector foresters, so it should make all of that a little bit easier for landowners to do.
You also, at myminnesotawoods.org, you have that schedule of events that's real easy. It's a calendar of telling people when and where certain events are going to take place. And I want to ask you about two coming up real soon, one this Friday and then one next Monday. They are BioBaylor woody biomass harvest demonstrations. One's in the Floodwood area and one's in the Grand Rapids area. And tell us about what it means in terms of woody biomass harvesting and why people might be interested in this in more than just for forestry reasons.
Yeah, sure. Well, there's been a lot of attention to woody biomass as an alternative energy source lately. There have been a lot of studies down here on campus and up at UMD through the Natural Resource Research Institute and other places looking at the feasibility of large and small-scale biomass energy production. And so one reason people are interested in that is that they see woody biomass as a way to offset fossil fuels, improve energy independence, and so on. But another reason is that it's a great way to improve wildlife habitat, at least for certain species. And in fact, these two demos, one of them is organized, the one in Grand Rapids, which is on Monday, March 15th, is organized by the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. And their focus, it all kind of wraps together, but their focus is on wildlife habitat improvement. And So what are these things? Woody biomass or harvesting is just really like it sounds. It's a process of removing woody biomass, woody material, and getting that material to an energy production facility, whether it's a small local facility or a larger regional facility. We're seeing both of those pop up and be considered around here. And there are a couple of important ways to do it. One way to do it is to harvest that woody biomass, what's called residual biomass, from timber harvest sites. That focuses on harvesting the limbs and the tops of trees that are not really merchantable in traditional markets, but certainly do constitute a large volume of material that can produce a lot of energy. So one approach is residual biomass. The other is to focus on brushlands and keeping brushlands open to favor and to produce the kinds of habitat that some wildlife species need. We see a lot of attention to this around sharp-tailed grouse, and in fact there was just a fantastic symposium on sharp-tailed grouse management last fall up in the Grand Rapids area. They are pretty interested in this approach for wildlife habitat benefits. And so, you know, it's not the answer to everything. It's certainly not right for every landowner, but these two demonstrations will be a good way for landowners and natural resource professionals to see one of these machines in action. So there's one in Floodwood. I think it's just northwest of town on the 12th, which is this Friday, and then another demonstration in the Grand Rapids area organized by the Deer Hunters Association on Monday the 15th. And as you pointed out, Scott, we've got all those details on My Minnesota Woods under the upcoming events link on the left side of the page.
Right. Now, you've got another webinar coming up. First, tell us again what the webinars are and what's the topic for this month.
Sure. Well, a webinar is one of these kind of fancy internet words. It means a web-based seminar. And what these are is they're 45, 50-minute presentations, not unlike a presentation you would get or you would see at a local woodland owner workshop or other kind of event. It's all online, though, so you can just tune in. If you register at our website, we'll send you a web address that you just have to click on. And you'll see that presentation in streaming video on your computer. We've done two of them so far, and full recordings are now available on our website. The first one was Five Things Every Woodland Owner Needs to Know. That was in January. The second one was Mel Bauman talking about property tax and incentive payment programs. That was a pretty popular one that aired in February. This month, my colleague in Brainerd, Giomi Zamora, is going to be talking about carbon credits for Minnesota woodland owners. Carbon credits were really in the news a lot. About a year ago, carbon markets have declined a little bit. Prices have gone down a little bit after the Copenhagen summit, and things have changed just a little bit. And Giomi will give landowners an update on what's up with carbon markets. And for those unfamiliar, carbon credit markets are a market-based program that could provide landowners with payments, annual payments, you know, that recognize forests' role in sequestering carbon, pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. Certain industries have incentives to reduce their carbon output, and if they exceed certain levels of carbon outputs, you know, they have to buy these credits. So it's a way for landowners to make money on it. It's all tied in with some bigger national policy issues related to cap and trade and so on. And again, things are in a little bit of a quiet stage right now. There hasn't been quite as much interest in the last several months on this topic, but I think it's going to come back again, and Giomi will give us an update. That's on St. Patrick's Day over the lunch hour. It's March 17th, starting at noon. And again, all the information's on the website.
Right. Finally, Eli, I always like to ask you about the discussion board. What's happening on the discussion board, and any things that have come to your attention in the last month over the discussion board?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. There's been a great discussion. A fellow named Ray Lever has been asking questions about some red pine harvested on a neighbor's property. It had some heart rot, some decay in the middle of the logs. They did a thinning in their red pine stand, and Ray was trying to figure out what might have caused that decay and what's going to happen with the future of that stand. We had a good discussion about that. Another landowner wrote in with a question, just bought a lakeshore property with some cottonwood right down near the lake, and there's some bark missing, and that individual was concerned about the safety of those trees and wondering what he should do about that. So that's up there as well. Another question about small-scale tree plantings. Somebody, I believe in Sherburne County, had a question, just had a few acres, wanted to establish oak on their property, and was wondering how to do that. So good questions this month, and there are a couple of others up there as well.
Eli Sager is a forester with the University of Minnesota Extension Service, and we visit with him every month to find out what's new at myminnesotawoods.org. We talk about some of the things, and there's a lot more there at the website. Thanks again, Eli.
My pleasure, Scott.
Talk to you next month.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We were speaking earlier in the program with Elaine Evans about bees, and members of the North Central Beekeepers are offering an introduction to beekeeping class this Saturday, March 13th, from 1 to 5 o'clock. That'll be at the Northam Arboretum in Brainerd. You can learn what you need to start a beekeeping operation, from equipment to bees. Advance registration is requested. Walk-ins are welcome if there is room. And also at the Northland Arboretum, Carol Henderson from the DNR's Non-Game Wildlife Program will lead a program on woodworking for wildlife this Thursday evening at 7 o'clock at the Northland Arboretum. That's in Brainerd. Henderson is the author of a best-selling book on building homes for birds and other wildlife. That program's free and open to everyone. For more information, call KAXE 218-326-1234. That's Phenology Plus for this Tuesday evening. I'm Scott Hall with John Latimer. Thanks for listening.